you know, lots of great tech teams, you know, just never really kind of hit their potential. I mean, that's kind of a common, and there's a lot of companies that hit potential, probably didn't deserve it.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo AdTech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce. And we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
This week, we are stoked to welcome Steve Latham to the show. Steve was, until recently, global head of analytics at Flash Talking, a company that offered an independent ad server, dynamic creative, and advanced measurement tools. Flash Talking was acquired by MediaOcean in December 2021 for a reported $500 million. Steve was the founder and CEO of Encore Media Metrics, which was acquired by Flash Talking in 2015. Before founding Encore, Steve was founder and president of Spur Interactive, a marketing agency. Today, Steve spends his time with Donate Stock, a nonprofit he founded to help investors donate stock to charities. Just to kind of get things started on a random sort of personal side note, we like to start there. We heard that you were a management consultant at BCG for less than a year back in the 90s. Did I get that right?
What happened, Steve?
More like 3 months. It was very evident that management consulting was not for me. And I found myself thinking this is, I've got this entrepreneurial kind of bug in me, and it's probably not going to be nurtured very well here. So it was by mutual agreement, not a good fit.
Like House of Lies? That looked like a lot of fun.
A new original series about a hotshot management consultant.
Give me a case. I'll solve the shit out of it.
Leading an unscrupulous team of hustlers into the trenches of corporate America.
I didn't really work with any Don Cheadle characters. But what really drove me to start a digital marketing services company was we had spent all this time and money designing, building a site for the startup I had been with, this security software company called Pentasafe. And we had the site live, like, great, how do we know if it's working? How do we market it? How do we get people to it? It was just like blank stares all around, and no one had any idea what you do to, you know, drive traffic to your site, or how do you measure performance or its impact.
I love that you just leaned in on the measurement side. That's exactly what pulled me into marketing in the first place. I'm totally with you.
Yeah, and did not know what I did not know. I learned a lot over the next two decades. So it was a lot of fun. And just, you know, we started off doing just basic stuff like email marketing, SEO, pay-per-click, site optimization. And then one day, a guy that I'd known actually from the incubator days, who was at the time Accenture, that this time he landed at FedEx Kinko's as head of digital products, and they were launching this product. So he called me up because he knew I was doing something in online marketing. He's like, hey, do you do media planning and buy and sell? Of course we do. We had never done it, by the way. I said, sure, of course we do. So he's like, great. Well, I have a digital product. It needs to be supported with digital media. So like banner ads, you guys do those, right? Oh yeah, of course. No worries, Kermit. We can do that for you. And so right after I got the phone, I was like, okay, what do we do? How do you do banner ad advertising? So it was, you know, a month of quickly trying to figure out how do you do media planning, buying, ad serving, reporting, all that stuff. Cause we just done kind of lower funnel stuff. And then we launched the FedEx Kinko's product. It was like the first cool product e-commerce thing where you could actually print from your computer to a FedEx Kinko's near you. We had so much success with that one day my client's name is Gurmeet. He called me up and was like, hey, I want you to manage our search budget for our brand terms for FedEx Kinko's. I was like, okay, that sounds great. That was a big budget, right? And it was happened to be Digitas was their agency of record. So then it was this really weird situation where we're a small little shop in Texas, you know, contacting Digitas for the rights to the FedEx Kinko's, then became FedEx Office search campaign. So it was really kind of an exciting / scary time. And eventually we're like, I guess we're an agency. So we started change ourselves to digital agency and grew and thought we were at 30 people about to go to 50. And there was some really big acquisitions taking place. It was interesting, like Modem Media, who John Nardone later came to work with and work for, was Modem Media, which had just gotten acquired for a ton of money. We're like seeing, oh, wow, we're going to build this digital agency. We're going to acquire it for $1 billion. And be fantastic. And then Then the recession happened in 2008, 2009. And basically, I've got a TV commitment. I'm signing a contract. I've already committed to spend, you know, $2 million with them. We have a print, you know, our print ads, our circulars. We were committed on those. Those are annual contracts. This is the only month-to-month discretionary money I've got, so I need it back. Yeah. So we shrank from 30 people to 6 people. That was really fun. After all we'd done is grow, shrank by 80%. And that's when I realized, like, if you can be really good at what you do and your clients love you, yet you can still shrink by 80%, you're just in a bad business. So I was like, I'm not rebuilding an agency. This is just too much.
Bad, I mean,
timing. We almost died. Yeah, we almost died several times and ran out of money. And then, but we had acquired a little software coming out of Austin, Texas, and had built out our own measurement capabilities, which at the time was pretty progressive. This is like 2008, and we were trying to figure out how to get past last click or click-based reporting as last touch attribution or click-based reporting, which is always the standard, the default in reporting for whether it's ad servers or search or publishers, whoever's reporting is all based on click-based. And my FedEx client was the one who was really pushing us on this because he was like, he's like, Steve, like, if I just look at your reporting, this, I would never buy any more display because it's terrible. But at the same time, I see when we increase our spend and display, we're seeing a lot more leads come through search. So we need to connect those dots. So we went back to the drawing board, I think it's 2008, and we realized that if we could set a cookie from our own domain on the ad impressions, and then we had that our own site track, our site analytics software. So we had our own domain, our own analytics platform. And if we did that, then we could actually assemble that customer journey and see all the touch points, you know, the impressions, that exposure, clicks that led to a subsequent click and a visit and a conversion, which is really kind of the early, you know, early days of MTA or multi-touch attribution. 2009, we started kind of commercializing that. And by 20, as the agency business was, you know, in the vicious cycle of contracting, I realized there was a huge problem with measurement that we had a pretty unique solution to. I used to go to these iMedia conferences, which were really a lot of fun, great boondoggles. And so going to a few of those, and I just heard guys like Art Muldoon and Matt Kreitz. I remember these guys were like big agency guys who were thinking about building their own programmatic management platform, which became Accordant Media, and they did really well. In Art, but it had been head of analytics at Aegis, or a senior guy, and he was saying how at Kara, Aegis, they were still relying on last touch. And I told him what we were planning to do from an MTA. He was really encouraging. He's like, definitely do that. And then a guy named John Durham, who many of us knew and loved, who just passed away a few months ago. He was basically the grandfather of these iMedia conferences. His firm organized him, marketed him, and he was really supportive. And he's like, I think it's a great idea. I'll help put together an advisory board for you. You know, I'll invest in you. Go do it. So I did it. And so in 2010, I got rid of sold our what was remaining of our agency clients and team, and kept our software and like one person. We started the company, started Encore, and that was kind of how it started out. And Encore, the name was actually an accident. Just, you know, weird story. It was actually supposed to be Envoy, like, you know, your digital envoy, like kind of like your emissary. And I was presenting, somehow I'd gotten connected to some guy at LendingTree, and I was presenting him. He's like, oh yeah, I saw your presentation a couple months ago. I'm like, well, tell me more about that, because I just started this. And I'd done trademark searches, domain searches, all this stuff. I go to Visual IQ, and sure enough, their multi-touch attribution product was called Envoy. I was like, so I'm looking at the name, like, what looks like that?
We could keep the E,
keep the N, keep the O. And then I literally like had 30 minutes to figure something out. I came up with Encore. I was like, okay, this is kind of a second act.
So you dissolved your agency in 2010 or 2009, 2010.
Sold it for a ton of money. Not really a lot of money, not much money. Enough to basically give it a little runway to start Encore.
But it was a small agency though, huh? You had 6
Yeah, people, yeah, right? Yeah, basically.
And then you moved, yeah, you decided to move to New York. What was that all about?
You had to be there, just had to be there.
Where
be
was that?
Serious.
You mentioned setting cookie from your own domain. So can you sort of talk us through that transition a little bit? Because I know this is around the time you mentioned Visual IQ, MTA was starting up. How does that work exactly?
The pain point was that all the reporting was based on last touch reporting, either last impression served on post view or post, you know, or click based. And we knew that we were beginning to realize there was a lot more, you know, digital was not just a direct response medium, especially display, that you could create a lot of awareness with ads that could have impact despite the lack of a click. So that was the idea, is how do you figure out, or the challenge is, how do you connect impressions served to Marty when he converts, you know, 2 weeks later through a paid search or an organic search or a direct nav to the site? How do you assemble that customer journey? And the only way you could do that back then was you had to basically have a using your third-party cookies, have it from the same domain. We were using a ad server that didn't exist anymore at the time. It was called True Effect. And they would allow us to set a cookie from our domain. So we had our own site analytics platform. It's called Site Compass, was our domain. And then we had a Site Compass impression tracker that was able to basically set an impression cookie on when people are exposed to the ads, display ads. So all of a sudden we can start assembling a path of ad exposure that was served to the user before they came to the site, and then when they converted, and then the sources of the visits. And that's what allows us to assemble all the touch points in the customer journey, or which basically underpins attribution modeling. Mm-hmm. So we pulled all that data together and started doing that 2000, really kind of commercially 2009, 2010, and then is Encore in 2011.
What happened to True Effect, by the way?
Great tech.
They were in Colorado, right?
Good people. They were in Denver. Yeah, Boulder. They had a great product. They actually had a patent on first-party ad serving, which is unique back then. But just, I don't think they just never really caught fire. You know, lots of great tech teams. You know, just never really kind of hit their potential. I mean, that's kind of a common. And there's a lot of companies that hit potential probably didn't deserve it.
Well, I know Visual IQ used to work with them sometimes too, depending on the customer.
Yeah, yeah, they were good tech stack.
But would it have been possible to do what you did using DoubleClick cookie?
No. You couldn't, because Google would not let you have, you know, set a cookie from your domain. You know, just what a small world it is. Ari Paparo, he was product manager at DoubleClick. And at the iMedia conference, I met him back in 2010. I was like, could we ever set a cookie from our domain? He kind of laughed. He's like, no, you can't do that. But can we get a history of impressions served to a user? No, you can't do that. I was like, okay. So we realized it was going to be really tough. To get, you know, with DoubleClick, which was the 95% market share of ad server back then. Yeah. So it was a tough problem to solve, and that's why you had to kind of be creative.
I have a question. Where was Encore actually based? Like, what was the office like? Tell us a little about the culture.
We were at WeWork and basically 28th and Park. We were lean and mean and like bootstrapping that was probably the most, and I didn't want to pay rent. Like, it was like, why pay rent? Yeah, it's crazy.
Was it fun? I mean, were you guys totally energized and you saw a great opportunity?
It was. And when Clear Sailing got bought by a lot of money back in, again, early days, probably 2000,
eBay, right?
Let's call it. It was like GSI Commerce, it then got bought by eBay. Right. So we got like a double hit in like 3 months, and went, you know, from bootstrapper to, you know, what do I do with all this money kind of lifestyle. So it was exciting because we were solving real problems and we had a viable solution that was working, and it was just, it was a lot of fun. It wasn't so fun in a few years later when a few of these really, you know, well-funded companies hit the scene and just, you know, we just got drowned in their wake for a while, almost drowned, I should say. It was like the Adometries and
Convertro.
Yeah, Convertro. Oh my God, yeah, total over-promotion, just a bunch of BS, frankly. Like, I mean, stuff, people, they got value on stuff that never really worked. It's just so hard to scale analytics without a consultative, because it's very consultative without a consulting organization. I don't know, not a lot of companies came in this space. What was weird is, Marty, you said over there, there's that original early crop or vintage of us and a few others. And then there's a couple others that popped in, but that was pretty much it. There wasn't, you know, if you go back early days, there was like Market Share. There was Visual IQ, there was us, there was the guys at C3, good guys, you know, bootstrappers as well. Then Adometry kind of came on. Abacus, short life, but good work, good product. There was a handful, 6, 7. You looked like 7, 8, 9, 10 years later, same group, right? It wasn't like one of these areas where it got flooded. And I think it spoke to the complexity and the difficulty of doing it. People realize, one, it's easy to kind of do it once in one use case, but to be able to then have the flexibility to customize it for each advertiser, for each agency, for their workflow, for the use cases, became really challenging.
Did you guys, the attribution providers, did you compete on the quality of your algorithm?
Invariably, you do. Yeah, you have to. Our head of data science, really had a unique, his approach on this was really, really well done. He came out of research. So okay. It was about how do you validate the accuracy of your predictive model? And for us, it was just, we were like, we have all the data. So we came up with an idea called ensemble modeling, you know, using multiple models and then using a holdout of the data to actually measure the predictive accuracy of the model. So we take, let's say you had, you know, 10,000 conversion paths, we 20% and put them aside of the a representative sample of maybe 20% of all the paths, set them aside for validating the models. And then we train on the 80% until the models figure out which ones actually were as they were hitting levels of efficiency. We then say, okay, predict how many converters and non-converters are in each group in the holdout group. And we could actually measure the actual. So we could measure what was predicted versus the actual. And so we would measure the sensitivity, the specificity, and to get the overall accuracy. And we'd share that with the advertisers, like, here's the accuracy of the models. So we actually provided transparency.
So what kind of customers did this work with?
I mean, it really worked with anybody because the conversion itself could take a lot of different forms. It doesn't have to be a purchase. It could be registration. It could be hitting goal pages on your site. If your goal is to get people deep in the funnel on the site, knowing that's indication that they are interested, they're there, or just hitting a goal page, a product, you know, in reading a case study, hitting a product specs page, something, again, if it's B2B, B2C, doesn't really matter. We had everything from telco to retail to financial services.
So we talked about this in the past, Steve, but I know over time, Google would gradually restrict access to data in the name of privacy. How did that impact measurement? They stripped out IP address.
Yeah, it actually goes way back. Both Google and Apple, I think they're both great, fantastic companies, but I also think they're a menace to the free idea of a free ad-supported internet. So Google started with, back in the days, the easy days, like you could actually get the actual queries in paid search. So if you're on a paid search campaign, you could actually see what people typed in their search. And Google realized if you know the specific queries, then you could start really putting more of your focus on SEO, which make you less reliant on pay-per-click, or you could start doing a very precise matching, like exact match ads, which were less competitive because people were buying like the broader terms, right? So Google started obfuscating search queries back in 2014. That was a long time ago, 8 years ago. They were basically saying, okay, you don't get to see what people are searching for anymore, but you will get to see the ad word, the key, the ad that was triggered. So you could be buying blue widget when it's actually, you know, men's blue widget, you know, Lower East Side, whatever, right? So and had you known that, you could save a ton of money. And they started blocking third-party cookies on YouTube probably about the same time. I mean, you've never been able to get good YouTube insights. And it was kind of a weird, I think it was like them testing the waters, how far can we go here in terms of obfuscating data and access to that with advertisers. You know, when are they going to scream with their wallets and stop spending? And the answer is they won't. So they did that. And then I think the big wrecking ball was the removal of the, you know, they called the ad ID, was the double click ID back in 2018 in the UK and the EU, you know, during GDPR, kind of in the name of privacy. And that was like a wrecking ball to all these analytics platforms and companies and teams that had built everything based on double click data. And you could no longer get a user ID, which made it possible to assemble paths, which made it possible to do anything but rely on last touch reporting. And they claim they're going to do the same in the US, like, you know, some point in the future. And they didn't really do that. They just stopped providing the log files that you would need to asset to match all the impressions, clicks, conversion data, visit data with all of the with the exposure data all tied to that user ID. So that was also the big thing that just devastated the European advertisers for a while. It still did, really, because it never came back. And that's kind of what put us all in, you know, kind of froze the field here in the US, made anyone afraid to continue to invest in that, knowing that Google can take it away at any time. And you want to go to Apple now? Because that's my other.
Yeah, like, well, we did have Apple. Yeah, why don't we just address them? ATT and ITP and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and this was before we started. I was kind of joking how I don't miss. I am retired from ad tech. I did my 20, and I'm feel like a veteran that, you know,
like a state police officer.
Yeah. Well, it is. It really is. It's a tough grind. So I can speak pretty freely. So I love Apple. I'm all Apple. I have been all in on Macs for 15 years on every regard. I really been very frustrated about, you know, where the liberties are taken in the name of privacy, which I feel like today is really just not too far from what Google's doing and claiming its privacy, but at the end of the day, it's about, you know, commercial objectives. I did not miss was every time Google made an announcement or Apple made an announcement, ITP or ATT, it was like a brush fire set off.
Say hello to my little friend!
And it's like, okay, drop everything, do the research, put together POV, try to calm everybody down and explain, you know, how this will or will not impact the ability for advertisers to target, to personalize, to measure, you know, how, what does this mean for them, right? Because every headline was so ominous from Google or Apple going, you know, for the last 5 years since ITP started in 2017. What's interesting is as Apple started blocking third-party cookies, and it was either 08 or 11. It was a long time ago. It was a long, long time ago. We haven't had any cookies, you know, by default since then, but basically, you know, everybody just kind of ignored it, yeah, and just got comfortable with that. And then with ITP, which really blocked the cross-site domain tracking, why that became a big deal, because that started impact your ability to track conversions of click-based conversions, right? So, and tracking the user across, you know, multiple sites before making a conversion. So, yeah, assembling the customer journey, even if you were able to get the impression data. But especially with these first party click bouncers like the like Criteos of the world that were crafty saying, oh, we'll put our tag on your site. And if you click on it, then you, when you click from one page to the next, we're going to route you through our server. Now you're first party. Now we can set a first party cookie in your browser, even though you're on a third party site. So that redirect. Was a lot of what ITP yes. was doing. Yeah, the redirects and doing that to try to block those loopholes also aimed a lot largely at Facebook and Google, what they were doing. So that, you know, then it became, then ATT, you know, the announcement came out in what, I think it was in June of 20 when they announced that. And it is the first domino in the towards the end of free content. So, you know, everyone knows in the industry, like the addressable inventory versus non-addressable inventory and the value. If you can target an ad to somebody or retarget somebody, it's, you know, it's 4 or 5x more valuable to an advertiser than just blind inventory. And we as an industry, I think, did a terrible job. What we really failed was exchanging or communicating value exchange to consumers. Like, yeah, we need some anonymous data. Here's what we can do with it. Here's what we can't do with it. But we need this in order to provide the ads, the value to advertisers to give you this free content. So you get free news, you get free recipes, free directions, free whatever it is, weather, news, sports, all this stuff, right? You get all this for free, and we do it, but because we're using anonymous data to provide ads that are gonna be more relevant to you. You're gonna get ads anyway. So when you'd rather be more personalized, more relevant. And we can do things like control frequency capping, so you're not followed around the web necessarily. There's a lot of things we can do to make your experience better. But more importantly, if you want free content, this is the cost.
Can we go back and talk about Flash Talking for a moment? Why did they acquire Encore in 2015?
Oh, John Nardone, that is he was brought in by the board in 2015, early 2015, to kind of, Flash Talking was a fledgling startup in kind of rich media and personalization over in the UK. And so John realized like the big opportunity was to make it more of a broader ad server to compete head on with DoubleClick and others. So leveraging its data-driven kind of DNA, because everything is data-driven personalization. So we already had the data-driven DNA, but let's also extend it. We have a very user-friendly ad server for agencies for standard ads and wrap all that up with really good data and analytics and insights. And so he had actually, we met when he was running a company called X+1 back in 2011, I think, and had talked briefly about, you know, possibly working together then. So when I saw he landed at Flash Talk, I shot him an email. And he's like, hey, you've been on my list. Let's talk. Where are you off scene? I'm like, I'm at WeWork. Come on, let's come over. And he was over a couple of days later, and we kind of fleshed out, you know, structure for a deal because it just made so much sense. We were a good tool looking for a home. They were a platform looking for some more advanced analytics capabilities. So it was a really great fit, and culturally worked really well.
Did he come to meet you in at WeWork? Did you say
he did? Yeah.
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 Really?
It's like,
nice.
Come check out my sweet digs here. Maybe.
Was he impressed?
No, I don't think he cared. Frankly, I think he was his hair was on fire trying to, you know, brand new CEO, and we were the first acquisition, right? So that was also a bit of a leap of faith too. Well, actually, second, they acquired Device9 right before us, but that was just a buying some tech over from Germany for us to buy customer facing platform and team was, you know, a bit of a risk. So I always appreciated him putting his neck out, and it worked out really well. Yeah.
I went to that Flash Talking office. I remember. Yeah. It was humming. It was really humming.
It was good energy, you know, lots of fun. It was at the same time, you know, run by adults. That was for me really important. Cause I'd seen a lot of the other types of companies along the way.
You want to tell us what Donate Stock does and how can people get involved?
I'd heard that the benefits of donating stocks to the cash, you could actually avoid the capital gains tax on whatever on the non-cash asset and be able to write off the full value of it. And I researched that and said, wow, this is too good to be true. This is so much better than donating cash. So I went through the process of donating stock to a scholarship fund that had given me a scholarship back in college. And it was such a hassle and so painstaking, I never did it again. I'll spare you the details, but it took about a week of me making calls, faxes. It was just such a hassle. I was like, this is why no one donates stock. It's such a pain in the ass, pardon my language. It was just so hard. So I don't know, a couple of years ago, I was thinking about this. I was like, I was thinking surely somebody has made this easy and modernized this and digitalized it and made it an easy service. And no one had. So I was still Flash Talking, but I was like, okay, this is a really important idea. Basically figuring out how to, you know, build a platform that could make it easy for you to donate appreciated stock to any charity. So it's trying to about creating awareness to educate people on the benefits of donating stocks to cash and doing it where in 10 minutes you can donate appreciated stock, what used to take a week, and the charities then get access to a whole new source of funding, bigger gifts, transfer money from the IRS to the nonprofits by making a pre-tax gift instead of after-tax. And there's just, it's a win-win. Everybody wins.
Do you have a website? Donatestock.com?
Yeah, donatestock.com. Thank you. They're simple. So simple.
Well, it'd be nice to see, you know, people in the tech business who've made so much money in stock, help people.
Yeah, it's like, we got to give back a lot of money. You can't wait till end of life to accounts for giving back.